With the speed of light, a cloud of dust, and a hearty hi-yo Silver, the Lone Ranger. With his faithful Indian companion, Tonto, the daring and resourceful masked rider of the plains led the fight for law and order in the early western United States. Nowhere in the pages of history can one find a greater champion of justice. Return with us now to those thrilling days of yesteryear. From out of the past come the thundering hoofbeats of the great horse, Silver. The Lone Ranger rides again.
Come on, Silver. Let's go, big fellow.
The Lone Ranger and Tonto were riding east from Salt Lake City along the route that was used by the Overland Mail. They rounded a bend and suddenly they saw three Indians pursuing a rider who spurred his horse desperately in a race for his life.
Come on, Tonto, we'll help that man. Come on, Silver!
Let's count!
As Silver shot hoofs pounded the plains, the masked man and Tonto drew their guns and started firing from the saddle. The surprised Indians turned as bullets streaked close to them, too close for comfort. They turned their ponies and headed for the hills. Their intended victim drew rein.
Ho, ho!
He turned to thank his rescuers.
Oh, you silly big fella. Oh.
Thanks a lot, mister. They almost got... Oh, your mask.
My mask needn't worry you.
You've proved yourself a friend.
Tonto and I are planning to camp in the hills not far from here. Will you accept our hospitality?
I'll be glad to.
Good, let's go. Come on, Silver!
Come on, Tonto!
As the Lone Ranger and Tonto made camp, their guest identified himself as Ed Creighton and explained that he was a line builder for Western Union. During the evening meal, Creighton was sure that he had found two men who could be trusted. He decided to speak frankly.
I told you I work for Western Union.
Yes, but why are you here? The telegraph line comes no farther west than Omaha. Well,
confidentially, we're planning to extend our line to the Pacific.
Oh?
I've been mapping the route for the transcontinental line. I'm on my way back to New York with a report from my boss, Hiram Sibley.
What route have you chosen?
The Pony Express route, from Omaha to San Francisco.
San Francisco, huh? A transcontinental wire linking the east and the west.
But there's one problem. And I'll admit I don't know how it can be solved.
Oh, what's that?
Indians. As we move our lines westward, we'll be at their mercy. They'll undoubtedly attack our work crews, pull down the poles, cut the wires.
No, not if they're friendly. Try to persuade them to fight on your side.
Yes. That's easier said than done.
Tonto and I are acquainted with most of the tribes in the west. We may be able to help you.
Mister, if you would...
Count on it, Creighton. When you return with your work crews, your telegraph poles and your wires, I do not look for you.
The next morning, Ed Creighton resumed his journey. He traveled on horseback, on stagecoach, by mule train and railroad. 1861, he gave Hiram Sibley a detailed report of his trip. Sibley took the report to Washington, where he... When he was ushered into the chief, Sibley explained the plans of Western Union. Mr. Lincoln listened closely. Then...
Sibley, you'll find no trees for telegraph poles on the plains.
Mr. President, we'll haul our trees...
As you string lines to them?
The Indians have burned the homes of many settlers, but that didn't discourage pioneering. We're aware of the difficulties ahead of us, sir, but we believe the job can...
Confidence, Mr. Sibley. I wish I might share it appears dark. Fort Sumter since January. Unless supplies are sent to our men, they'll be starved into surrender.
The Confederates will open fire if we provision the fort.
Americans firing on their own flag. Brother against son. Civil war.
The transcontinental telegraph is vitally important in time of war, Mr. President.
I admit that, Mr. Sibley. But war is imminent, perhaps only months away. Even if it would take 10 years to string... But I'm wrong.
In that spring of 1861, the clouds of war were darker than most people reckoned. The rumble of catastrophe began in human intensity until the morning of the 13th day. It was 4:30 when artillery belched fire and smoke in shots at Fort Sumter. This was war. Lincoln called out 75,000 men. Mills, factories, railroads swung into action to provision, equip, and transport a nation at war. Now, more than ever before, rapid communication was required. Mail carried by even the fastest trains was far too slow. The Western Union telegraph offices, equipped by the magic of science for almost instantaneous communication, were swamped with urgent messages. The lines along the eastern seaboard and west as far as Omaha hummed with official orders, reports, and instructions. The telegraph lines ended at Omaha. Westward, news traveled slowly. It was months before Fort Kearney, Julesburg, Salt Lake City, and Sacramento learned that Fort Sumter had fallen and the nation was marching to war. By that time, Hiram Sibley's transcontinental expedition rolled westward. Wagon trains scattered along the route Creighton had mapped. They carried poles, heavy reels of wire, insulators and batteries to the plains, mountains, and Indian-infested wilderness. In Washington, President Lincoln frequently went in person to the telegraph office in the War Department. He often thought of Sibley and his hopes of spanning the nation with the magic wires as he watched the brass key and the words transcribed by the operators.
Mr. President, Jeff Davis is to be president of the Confederacy.
North Carolina has seceded, and Virginia.
South Carolina is withdrawn from the Union.
Georgia seceded.
Florida.
Alabama.
Mississippi.
Louisiana.
Texas.
Arkansas.
Tennessee.
Is the West with the Union? What of Missouri, Utah, California?
Well, no one knows, Mr. President. We haven't heard from the West.
The mails, even the fastest are slow. I would that Sibley might accomplish the impossible, but no. Even with God's help, there is a limit to what can be wrought by mortal man.
More and more of Mr. Lincoln's time was spent in the telegraph office of the War Department. Here on a warm July 31st, the president waited tensely for the telegraph key to spell out the news of Bull Run. McDowell was in command of the Union soldiers, and everyone believed the general would win a glorious victory. Suddenly, the quiet key began to pound. Lincoln strode across the room to stand beside it.
What is it, Wilson? What's happening at Bull Run?
It's bad news, Mr. President.
Huh?
The rebels have us on the run.
Our men are retreating.
Berg has won the battle.
Retreat.
The rebels have beaten us.
Our men are running away.
The day is lost.
The Yanks are falling back to the Potomac.
The soldiers came back to Washington, weary, heartsick, defeated. Cartridge powder streaked their faces and their ears still rung with the sound of gunfire. For many of the boys and men in the retreating army, it was the first taste of enemy shot. Mr. Lincoln was silent as he stood alone in the window of his office watching the survivors, the wounded and the dead pass through the street. The mighty army of the Potomac was straggling back to the Capitol with defeat at its heels. Meanwhile, Hiram Sibley's expedition continued west. Ed Creighton was in charge of the construction of the eastern line, with a man named Jim Gamble in charge of the western line. Work crews dug post holes and placed telegraph poles along the route traveled by the Pony Riders. At At a point between Fort Kearney and Julesburg, the long poles were planted and wire was strung loosely from post to post, hanging about 6 feet above ground. The weather had been extremely hot. Buffalo was scarce and other game had disappeared. Three young braves, one of them the son of Chief Eagle Feather, had spent the day searching for food. They were returning to their village at sundown, racing their spirited ponies. Black Hawk, the chief's son, was in the lead. As he rode, he looked back over his shoulder, shouting to his companions. Black Hawk was challenging his friends to match his speed, to overtake him if they could. The young warrior didn't hear his friend's warning. Straight toward the line of poles and low-hanging wire he raced. Then suddenly... The wire caught Black Hawk across the chest. He gasped in pain and surprise and fell to the ground. His friends drew rein and hurried to his side. Standing with his crew some distance away, Ed Creighton had seen the accident. He had mounted and quickly rode to join the two Indians and their fallen friend. He dismounted and moved to Black Hawk's side.
I saw you fall. How badly you hurt?
White man's line. Catch Black Hawk. Knock him from pony.
Yeah, he rode right into the wire. He's been watching where he was
you
going.
You go away.
Oh, I came here to help you.
Son of chief not want help.
You're the son of an Indian chief?
Me, Black Hawk, son of Eagle Feather.
Eagle Feather, great warrior.
Oh, see here, Black Hawk. I'm sorry you spilled from your horse. You might have broken a couple of
Black
bones.
Black Hawk, sir, you go away.
I'll help get him back to the village.
We help back to the village. Tell Chief Eagle Feather what happened to son.
Creighton knew Black Hawk had been hurt. The force with which he had hit the wire must have injured his ribs, possibly breaking one or two. But worse than any physical injury was the humiliation Black Hawk had suffered. With two of his friends as witnesses, he, the son of a chief, had been knocked from his horse and sent sprawling on the ground. The loss of dignity was enough to arouse any Indian. It would surely arouse the enmity of the Indian chief. That night, a scout named Soda joined Creighton as he stood beside the covered wagon studying the horizon.
Look at those hills, boss. Every one of them is alight with Indian signal fire.
I see them, Soda.
You know what they mean? They mean trouble. Engine trouble.
I was afraid of this. I wish I knew where to look for them.
You don't have to look for them, boss. Those fires are blazing bright enough for anyone to see.
I'm not talking about fires, Soda. I'm thinking of men. A masked man and an Indian. They saved me from redskins once. And I have a feeling I'll need help again. Mighty soon.
The curtain falls on the first act of our Lone Ranger adventure. Before the next exciting scenes, please permit us to pause for just a few moments.
This is Earl Smithsonian from the Top Hat Plateau Show on WBED. I've always wondered where the radio wave expired. And I found out where, here on the Grand Hour, on WMFO Medford.
To continue, the Lone Ranger and Tonto had been near Carson City when they heard that Ed Creighton and his crew were in the west, stringing the wire along the route the line builder had chosen on an earlier trip to the west. The masked man and Tonto started east at once, planning to meet Creighton. Halfway between Julesburg and Fort Kearney, they sighted Indian signal fires. The Lone Ranger and Tonto drew rein at the edge of the Indian village.
He's a big fellow.
He's got easy fellow.
They dismounted and made their way on foot past the wigwams that surrounded the council ring. They stopped and stood in the shadows of a wigwam in the center. They saw Chief Eagle Feather wearing his war bonnet and the painted warriors of the tribe gathered around the council fire, their attention fixed on the chief. Eagle Feather was speaking.
Oh, Eagle Feather, heap plenty man.
What's he saying, Tonto?
Indians go hunting, find no food. White man put trees without branches on plains. Drive away buffalo, all game.
It has been a bad hunting season. The crops have withered in the ground for want of rain.
Eagle Feather blame white man for Indian trouble. Oh, him say, him kill white man. Tear down poles. Them gonna start war dance.
Eagle Feather must not go on the war path. We'll try to reason with the chief. He'll remember us as friends. Come on, Toto. Let's hope he'll listen to us.
In Washington, President Lincoln also faced a dilemma. Salmon P. Chase, the Secretary of the Treasury, was in Lincoln's study, and Mr. Chase was discussing money.
Mr. President, uniforms, weapons, ammunition, food must be paid for. Our treasury is nearly empty. I've tried to bring the matter to the attention of Congress, but the senators do not realize the seriousness of the situation. We need gold and silver desperately, but speculation has driven it from circulation.
Mr. Chase, I know of only one place to secure more gold and silver.
Where, sir? Tell me where.
The Western mines.
I've thought of them. But we can't depend on the Western mines. Indeed, we're not sure that the West stands with us.
If we could know that California and Nevada and the territories of Colorado, Montana, Washington, Utah were behind our efforts with all their vast gold and silver resources...
Mr. President, we must face reality. Without gold and silver, we'll have to issue paper money.
There's nothing to back it up. That would destroy the value of our currency. Our money would become worthless paper.
I see no alternative.
As the president considered the problems of an empty treasury, Ed Creighton was confronted with disaster of a different sort. He and his crew of line builders were gathered around their supply wagons. Scouts had reported that Eagle Feather's braves were on the warpath, fearing attack. Creighton spoke grimly to his men.
All of you men stay close to the wagons. If you stray from camp, you're likely to meet a war party and lose your scalps.
Hey, boss, are you giving up the job and turning back?
Not on your life. We're going ahead. We continue setting the poles and stringing the wire.
Good.
Now, if the Redskins want to fight, we'll give it to them.
That's a ticket. We have rifles and plenty of ammunition.
And we'll pass out extra ammunition. Hank, break open those cartridge boxes.
Right, boss.
And Creighton!
Hey, what's up?
It's a mess, man.
You're covered, mister.
Get your hands up.
Hold to your guns.
But, boss...
You heard me. This man's a friend of mine.
Thanks, Creighton. He just said a big fellow.
Mister, I'm glad to see you. We're having Indian troubles.
Yes, I know. Todd and I were in Eagle Feather's village. Otto's there now, taking care of Black Hawk. He persuaded them to wait for 2 days before attacking.
Yeah, thank Tonto for me, mister.
Well, that'll give us time to send for reinforcements.
We'll be able to get more men to help us fight.
That isn't the reason Tonto asked for the delay.
What do you mean?
Creighton, is your line working from here to Fort Kearney?
Yes, but Fort Kearney's 2 days' travel from here.
The Indians are hungry. In order to stretch the food on hand, Eagle Feather's rationed his people. Each member of the tribe receives enough to sustain life. But even that will be cut off in 2 days when their supplies are exhausted.
Well, I didn't know things were that bad in the village. We'll be glad to help.
By helping them, you'll help yourselves.
You mean that we'll be able to win their friendship?
Yes, and you'll be able to prove that the telegraph is the most wonderful white man's magic they've ever seen. After a demonstration, they'll believe that it's a power for good.
Just tell me what to do, mister.
I'll bring Eagle Feather and a few of his men here.
When the Lone Ranger returned to the Western Union workmen at daybreak, he brought with him Chief Eagle Feather and four braves. The Indians wore war paint, and their eyes were flinty with suppressed anger as they looked at the men whom they blamed for their misfortunes. But they had promised the masked man to powwow in peace, and they intended to keep their word. They watched silently as Creighton connected a battery box and small brass instruments to the slender wire.
What him do?
You and your people use fire and smoke to send messages.
That right.
Well, my friend is about to send a message. His words will be carried many miles to a great city.
The watching Indians tried hard to conceal their superstitious fear as Creighton began to send a message. Their fear was increased many-fold when a few moments later the shining instruments began to sound with no one standing near as the reply to Creighton's request came from Fort Kearney.
What that?
A reply to my friend's message.
Me not see smoke or fire. How message sent?
The words travel through the wire. Creighton, Chief Eagle Feather might be interested in knowing the message you sent.
I asked for several wagons of food for the chief and his people.
How food get here?
In wagons from Fort Kearney.
They should arrive in 2 days. When it comes, you and your people will know that the white man's medicine is strong and good.
If medicine good, why it throw Black Hawk from pony?
Now, this telegraph wire was hanging about 6 feet from the ground. Black Hawk didn't see it and ran right into it.
We wait and see how medicine work. We wait 2 days. If food not come, Eagle Feather and Braves go on warpath.
The powwow ended. Eagle Feather and his men returned to the hills where they watched the crew on the plains below. The first day passed and the sun rose on the second. From time to time, Ed Creighton sat down at the telegraph instrument and checked the progress of the wagon train with men who were stationed on the line between this point and Fort Kearney. Chief Eagle Feather watched the horizon, and with him, the Lone Ranger. It was nearly sundown when the grim-faced chief said,
White man, lie to this chief. Food not come for Indian.
The sun hasn't set, Chief Eagle Feather. There's still time for the wagons to come.
When sun go down, my people fight. Tear down white man's medicine.
As the chief spoke, the big wagons came into view. The Lone Ranger saw them and smiled. Chief Eagle Feather saw them and stared in wide-eyed amazement. In camp with his men, Ed Creighton saw them and shouted,
There it is, boys! The wagon train from Fort Kearney!
We don't have to fight the Redskins!
This will put them on our side!
The Western Union men escorted the wagons to the Indian village. Bonfires were built, and for the first time in many weeks, the Indians had food enough for everyone in the tribe. Chief Eagle Feather stood in the council ring with the Lone Ranger and Ed Creighton. Creighton said,
This is the first of a series of wagon trains, Chief. We'll keep you supplied with food till the dry spell's ended, and you have crops enough to feed your people.
No, this, Chief, no white man's medicine. Plenty strong, plenty good. Me glad, masked friend and Tonto, come. Stop Indians from starting war.
There'll be no war, Chief.
That right.
Good. Now what, Ed?
Now we'll go back to work, mister. And I hope you'll stay with us till the job is done.
Tonto and I'll be nearby, but from now on, it's up to you and your men.
From now on, you'll see real speed, mister.
Word of the power of the telegraph spread rapidly among the Western tribes. As the work progressed, the Lone Ranger and Tonto found increasing numbers of Indians ready to help make white man's medicine. There was an abundance of manpower to cut and trim trees, haul them into position, and set them firmly in holes. August passed, and then September. The line was extended to South Pass and Fort Bridger, while Jim Gamble's crew strung wire from San Francisco, Sacramento, Carson City, and Fort Ruby. Creighton and Gamble raced to close the gap, linking the line from east to west. In New York City, Hiram Sibley maintained telegraphic contact with Creighton and with President Lincoln in Washington. He reported to the president how the friendship of the Indians had been won. And then one day in October, the president was in the War Department telegraph room with Salmon Chase, the Secretary of the Treasury. Both men were hollow-eyed from worry and lack of sleep.
Mr. President, here is an intelligence report that is the realization of my worst fear. The rebels have sent agents abroad to enlist the aid of England and France. England and France are sympathetic to their cause. The Confederates are capitalizing on that sympathy. They're trying to borrow European gold.
Mr. President.
Yes, what is it, Wilson?
Messages are coming from the west, sir.
From Omaha?
No, sir, from far beyond Omaha. Here, sir, this is from Utah.
Utah, let me have it.
There are other messages coming through.
Lincoln took the message, and as he read it, Secretary Chase saw the rugged face relax. The president looked up, and there was new hope in the eyes that had known anxiety and troubled grief.
Mr. Chase, you were worried about the Confederates financing their war effort with foreign gold. Sir, we shall finance the Union with our own gold and silver.
But, Mr. President, how?
This message is from Brigham Young in Salt Lake City. It says, Utah stands firm with the Union.
Gold and silver from loyal Utah.
Here are other messages, Mr. President.
Yes. Mr. President, with Utah, we are assured of the support of that territory west of Omaha as far as California.
Yes, Mr. Chase.
If only the telegraph were finished all the way.
It is. Our nation is connected from the Atlantic to the Pacific.
But California, sir. How? Where?
This message is from Chief Justice Stephen Field in California. He says that California pledges her loyalty and her resources to the Union.
Then the telegraph has been extended to California. But it cannot stand. The Western Indians are hostile. They'll tear down the poles, cut the wire.
Yes, that's what I thought. But Mr. Sibley informed me that the friendship of the Indians has been won.
But how?
Mr. Sibley reported that one man was responsible for winning the cooperation of the Indians. A masked man, sir.
I've heard of a mysterious masked rider in the West. He's helped several officials in the government before.
He's helped us again.
To think of it. A nation united. Now, sir, if the Confederate States of the South were back with us...
They shall be, Mr. Chase. The struggle may be long. It may be bitter. But with the aid of Western resources, we are assured of victory. The future will see a truly United States of America, thanks to the efforts of the Lone Ranger.
This is a firearm safety PSA. No matter how you feel about current gun laws, everybody should know the most critical rules about handling any firearm. Rule 0. All guns are always loaded. Rule 1. Never point a gun at anything you are not willing to destroy. Rule 2. Keep your finger off the trigger until your sights are on target and you have made the decision to shoot. Rule 3. Be sure of your target and what is beyond it. A public safety message from WMFO in Medford, Tufts Educational Radio.
Gun safety. WMFO, Medford.
I'm experiencing some technical difficulties here. Sorry about that. Unfortunately, I'm unable to provide any background on the Lone Ranger regarding its original air date, its title, or any relevant production notes. Is that record skipping again? Sorry. The Lone Ranger series began in 1933. It met with some immediate success and was picked up by the larger Mutual Broadcasting System. The creation tandem of George Trindle and writer Fran Stryker. They developed another series 3 years later in 1936. And here it is for you.
The Green Hornet. He hunts the biggest of all game, public enemies who try to destroy our America. With his faithful valet Cato, Britt Reid, daring young publisher, matches wits with the underworld, risking his life that criminals and racketeers within the law may feel its weight by the sting of the Green Hornet. Ride with Britt Reid in the thrilling adventure of A Matter of Evidence. The Daily Sentinel was strongly opposed to Boss Cranshaw and the political machine he represented. Nevertheless, there were Sentinel reporters at the big political rally. Michael Axford and Lenora Case sat down in front near the reporters, columnists, and radio men.
Looks like the meeting is going to get underway in a couple of minutes, Casey.
Uh-huh. And I don't think I care for this kind of reporting.
Me neither. I'm a man of action. I like it better when things are buzzing.
Look at Boss Cranshaw up there. That smirk of his. Oh, I detest men like that.
By Gary Reed's many a time said he'd like to stick a pin in Cranshaw and see if hot air whooshed out like from a balloon.
Michael... Is it true that Cranshaw owns that big gambling house?
The Garden? Sure it is. But nothing can ever be proved. I know Commissioner Higgins would like to get the goods on Cranshaw.
Michael, look.
Huh?
Over there in the front row. Isn't that one of our men?
Where?
That fellow in the light suit. Yes, it is. It's that chap who works in the advertising department.
Jim Donald, sure enough. Now, what do you suppose he's doing at a rally like this? It can't be he's back in the Cranshaw machine.
Ladies and gentlemen.
Well, here we go, Casey. Sharpen your pencil.
As chairman of tonight's meeting, I give you that public-spirited individual, that man who is well known for his generosity, for his interest in public welfare, and the friend of the working man.
Hogwash.
I give you Big Bill Cranshaw.
Cranshaw, you're a dirty crook!
Michael, look at Donald.
Because of you and your crooked gambling games, I've lost everything I have.
Hey, he's blowing his top.
I swear I'd get you and I'll do it.
Michael, he has a gun.
Don't shoot, faggot!
I'm a peace-loving man, but by golly, Reed, I'd sooner see Cranshaw's name in the obituaries than in the headlines.
Michael.
I know what you mean, Axford.
That guy Donald is a punk shot. He missed him by a mile.
Men like Cranshaw lead a charmed life.
Now, it's too bad Jim Donald is connected with the Sentinel. Cranshaw hates us and all members of our staff.
That he does.
He'll see that Donald gets the limit.
I spoke to your attorney, Mr. Reed, as you told me to, and he said he'd handle the situation.
Good. As soon as young Donald is released on bail, I want you to talk to him, Miss Case.
Me? But, Mr. Reed, maybe someone with more experience
you
would
You wanted
be...
to be a reporter?
Yes, but I...
Now, talk to Donald and find out why he took a couple of shots at Cranshaw.
Well, Reed, we told you he said the Cranshaw had broken.
That's just it, Axford. I want the details, and I think Miss Case can get them.
Jim, why did you do it?
What's the difference, Miss Case?
You should have known you couldn't get away with anything like that in a crowded auditorium. You're lucky your bullets didn't wound Cranshaw.
Lucky?
Or worse, you might have killed him.
I wish I had. I'll get him. I'll get Cranshaw if it's the last thing I do.
What did he do to you?
His crooked games ruined me.
Crooked games?
Roulette. That gambling place called the Garden.
Oh, so that's it. You went to the Garden and you lost.
I lost, all right. I lost everything. Savings, home. Yes, even Madge. She's sure to die now that I can't help her.
Madge? Your wife?
Yeah. Oh, what's the use of talking about it?
Go ahead, Jim. Let's have the story.
That's an old... Madge needs an operation. Then a change of climate, a lot of rest and the right food. All those things. Well, I couldn't do it on my salary, so I took a few $100 I'd saved and went to the Garden.
And lost?
I lost. But I thought I had the game figured out. I was sure I could beat it. So I went in hock, borrowed all I could get on my house and insurance, and went back to the Garden. That game's as crooked as a corkscrew. It's as crooked as everything else that Cranshaw touches.
So you lost your cash, but... Well, what about Madge?
Well, we can't afford the things she needs, so she... She may have 3 months or... 6 months or...
Jim, I don't get it. Why did you shoot at Cranshaw? How could that help you or Madge?
Why go into that? I just want to get that crook, that's all.
You're not even sure that Cranshaw owns the Garden.
Yes, I am. Everyone knows it. Cranshaw owns 3/4 interest. The rest is owned by Trigg Burley.
Well, if you wanted to get Crenshaw, why didn't you get evidence that he operates a gambling place and turn it over to the police?
The police can't touch him. He's too big.
I doubt that.
Besides, by the time a raiding squad gets in, everything is out of sight.
Jim, if you'd only gone to Britt Reed with your trouble.
The boss? He has headaches of his own without worrying about small fry like me. I was just a cog in his machine.
Oh, is that so? Well, he posted your bail, and he hired lawyers to handle your case.
Look, Miss Case, what happens to me doesn't matter. I'm washed up. Tell Mr. Reed not to bother about me. If he wants to do something worthwhile, he can go after Boss Crenshaw.
Like you did, I suppose.
No, Reed doesn't need a gun. He's got power and influence. He should be able to find some way to put Crenshaw out of business so other saps like me won't get in a spot like this.
Jim, Mr. Reed is thinking along the same line.
Huh?
Do you know where he is right now?
Well, how would I know?
He's at the Civic Club with Police Commissioner Higgins. They're meeting to discuss Boss Crenshaw.
Why are you and the police so helpless? Is Crenshaw bigger than the law?
You know the answer, Britt. It's the old story of securing evidence that'll stand up in court. In the first place, Crenshaw has a pipeline into most of the city departments. He gets an advance tip-off on a raid.
Yes, but if...
Even he didn't have a tip, a raid would be ineffectual. The raiding party would have to go through the restaurant and a corridor behind the restaurant to reach the gambling room. By the time they got there, they'd find nothing but a few people gathered around small tables with refreshments.
I get the gambling equipment out of sight, huh?
Yes. Also, some of the patrons through a concealed door.
Suppose the police were to attack very suddenly through that door.
We can't locate it. What is it, Joe?
A message was left at the door for you, Commissioner Higgins.
Well, thanks, Joe. Excuse me, Britt. It may be urgent.
Well, if it is, we can continue our discussion another time. There must be some way to get evidence against the garden and prove that Crenshaw's the owner.
Well, this is interesting.
Huh?
Crenshaw has been at headquarters, demanding protection.
He has the audacity to make demands on the police?
He has a threatening letter. He's very much concerned about it.
I'm glad to know that he can be worried.
Apparently, he's very worried. He has requested a 24-hour-a-day guard.
Was this threatening letter, was it signed?
Oh, yes. Yes, Britt, it was signed. As if you didn't know. It was signed by the Green Hornet.
So Crenshaw is afraid of the Green Hornet. Well...
During the next few days, Boss Crenshaw had a police escort when he left his home, and a guard when he remained inside, and more threats from the Green Hornet.
Another letter. Look at this, Burke. Another threat from the Green Hornet.
Now, Mr. Crenshaw, you needn't get too excited about what he says in those letters.
I tell you, Burke, I'll not tolerate these threats.
Is that your front door bell?
Yeah, wait, Burke. You stay here. There's another policeman on duty near the door.
All right. All right, Mr. Crenshaw. Take it easy. I'm not leaving you alone.
The door.
Who is it?
Burke, there was a special delivery letter for Mr. Crenshaw.
Tell him to slide it beneath the door.
Slide it under the door. I'll get it.
More threats. Burke, you open it.
By golly, Mr. Crenshaw. You sure are letting the Hornet get under your skin.
Go ahead, open that. See what it says.
You seem to take it for granted it's another threat from the Green Hornet.
Why, is it?
Yeah. Just like the last one.
How much longer is this going to go on? What's the Hornet trying to do? What's his game?
Oh, golly, Mr. Crenshaw.
Don't argue with me. Go to that telephone and call Commissioner Higgins. Tell him that I demand the immediate arrest of the Green Hornet.
Oh, Gary Reed, you should hear the way Crenshaw's howling for the arrest of the Green Hornet.
Is that so, Axford?
Yeah. It seems like every time Crenshaw turns around, there's another letter or phone call or something from the Green Hornet. Two or three letters every day and phone calls at all hours of the day and night.
Oh, what's being done about it?
Well, the cops have got the dragnet out looking for the Hornet. But golly, Reed, what good does that do? How do the cops expect to catch the spalpeen? Even I can't catch him.
Cranshaw is worried?
Worried? Oh, golly. According to Burke, he's plenty scared.
I see.
I wonder what the Green Hornet is going to do next. And I'm not the only one that's wondering. Burke is wondering, and so is Cranshaw, and so is Commissioner Higgins.
Yeah, expert. And I'm wondering, too.
Brett Reed's dislike for the political boss, Big Bill Cranshaw, became crystallized when a young man in the advertising department lost everything in the notorious gambling place that Cranshaw secretly owned. The young publisher was in his apartment with Cato, his faithful Filipino valet.
I have it on good authority, Cato. Our campaign has been effective. The warning letters and phone calls have gotten under Cranshaw's skin. He's badly frightened.
What does Commissioner Higgins think?
Well, Commissioner Higgins admits that the police can do nothing about Cranshaw's gambling place. He's hoping the campaign of the Green Hornet will bear fruit.
Well, how you work that?
One of the Sentinel reporters told me about the back way out of that gambling room. I know where the door is.
If you tell police, perhaps they break in that way.
No, the door's too heavy, Cato. Take time to break it in. When the police did get in, there'd be no evidence of actual gambling. They have to be caught in the act.
Oh.
The door can be opened by someone who knows the trick. Now, we've got to make Cranshaw open that door so the police can get in fast.
What do we do?
Let's talk to Axford. He's at Cranshaw's home. His friend Sergeant Burke and several other policemen are guarding the boss.
And Axford is there?
Axford and representatives of the other papers. They're all waiting for the Hornet to make a move.
The last message from Green Hornet to Cranshaw was effective.
Yes, it was, Cato. Cranshaw was made to understand that there'll be a showdown tonight.
But how we do that with police guard near Cranshaw?
We'll have to trust to luck in the Black Beauty. Did you check the car?
We're ready for action.
We haven't used the smoke screen in a long time. Is that smoke-throwing device in order?
Oh, yes, sir.
We'll probably need it tonight.
How soon we go out as Green Hornet?
Right away. As soon as I get this hand grenade.
Now, Mr. Britt, you have a hand grenade bomb in dresser drawer.
I've been working with this one, Cato. It's special. Let's go.
Stepping through a secret panel in the rear of a closet in the bedroom, Britt Reed and Cato went along a narrow passageway built within the walls of the apartment itself. This passage led to an adjoining building which fronted on a dark side street. Though supposedly abandoned, this building served as the hiding place for the sleek, super-powered Black Beauty, streamlined car of the Green Hornet. Britt Reed pressed a button. The great car roared into life. A section of the wall in front raised automatically, then closed as the gleaming Black Beauty sped into the darkness.
Got about 17 more minutes left in the show. I was gonna end this episode here and play some music, but I believe I got enough time left to just play out the full episode, just so I can don't have to do play Act Two next week, the 14th of February. That's right, the Grand Hour is weekly, and this is Arthur. And you're listening to 91.5 FM WMFO, Medford Tufts Freeform Radio, and WMFO.org.
Boss Cranshaw's irritation and nervousness had been increasing hourly. His nerves had been made raw by the repeated notes and telephone calls from the Green Hornet. He paced the floor of his home uneasily. In the large library were Sergeant Burke and another uniformed policeman. Also, reporters, including Michael Axford of the Daily Sentinel.
What the... Oh, it's you.
Sorry, Mr. Cranshaw. I didn't mean to startle you.
What's up, Moran?
The car just turned into the block. It's coming this way slowly.
Holy crow. Maybe that's the Hornet.
Get your guns out.
Get your guns ready, boys.
If you look out the window, you can see.
Let me look.
Hey, expert, who are you shoving?
I'm going to be out in the front porch. I'm going to be ready to take a shot at the tires of that car if it proves to be the Harlot.
Here it comes.
Hey, whoever's driving, he's throwing a spotlight on the house.
Hey, look. Something's coming.
The window.
What is it?
Get back. Get out of the way. Looks like a bomb.
A bomb?
Get back! Moran! All of you! It is the Green Harlot!
Sitting behind the wheel of a Black Beauty, Rhett Reed, wearing the mask of the Green Hornet, led the police on a wild chase through the city streets.
Are they gaining on us, Cato?
No, Mr. Britt. We hold our own.
How many cars took after us?
I count three as we leave the vicinity of Cranshaw home.
I wonder how Cranshaw behaved when he saw that hand grenade go through his window.
Well, probably nervous, waiting for explosion.
He'll wait a long time if he waits for that dud to explode.
That's true.
Now, Cato, we've got to get away from those police for a few minutes.
Yes, sir.
Get ready to turn on the smoke. We'll put the police in an artificial fog, and by the time we reach the four corners up ahead, they won't know which way we went. Now, Cato, the smoke screen.
It turned on.
Hang on, Cato. Tough turn.
Plenty smoking back.
Another turn coming up. Here we go. Now to double back to Cranshaw's place. Cross your fingers, Cato, and hope that he's still there.
One guard had remained with Cranshaw when the other policeman and the newspaperman left in pursuit of the Green Hornet.
Are you sure that bomb won't go off?
Of course I'm sure. You can see for yourself the pin hasn't been pulled. You can relax, Cranshaw.
Relax? With all your vigilance, the Hornet would have blown up my home if he'd pulled the pin on that bomb.
He won't get another chance. The boys will run him down.
Wait a minute.
Huh?
Quiet. I heard something.
Some of the boys might have returned. I'll go find out.
There!
Mast, I'll get
you. The Hornet!
I'll get it.
Take it, copper.
Why, you...
Oh, wait, don't shoot me. Don't use that gas on me.
Shut up, Cranshaw. You'll get worse than the guard. Come with me.
Let me go. Where are you taking me?
Come on. I'll give you a chance to save your neck.
With the guard unconscious on the floor, Cranshaw struggled feebly in the iron grip of the Green Hornet. He was fairly dragged from the house to a black car that waited in the driveway. The man at the wheel was masked.
Get into that car.
Oh, police.
I hear them.
You can't get away with this.
Police lost ground fumbling through a smoke screen, but they'll be after us again. Go straight ahead. Drive through the fence at the rear and cut over that field to the next street.
There he goes, Burke. To the right at the corner.
Save your wind, Ashford. I got eyes.
By God, he's like all time to be chasing the Green Hornet. Reed and everyone else said there were no charges against him. But you just wait, Burke. There'll be plenty of charges after this night, and Cranshaw will make them. Step on the gas. Keep that car in sight.
We've got to shake the cops before I can talk to you.
Just what do you want of me? I've done nothing to you. Why have you threatened me?
Get this, Cranshaw. If the cops get too close, I'll have to rub you out. I don't want to do that. I want to talk to you. Get the facts I want and let you go.
What facts?
We can't talk with the police so close.
What'd we stop for?
The driver had instructions. Come on, get out.
Right.
You know this place.
Police coming close.
Turn on the smoke screen again, then get out of here. Get going.
Where are we going?
We're going someplace to talk without police interference. And you know where it is.
The Green Hornet hurried Cranshaw through an alley between two old buildings. A smoke screen that concealed the Black Beauty had thinned slightly as the police car stopped at the curb near the alley.
The police are stopping.
We've got to get away. Your life depends on it.
The Hornet stopped at a shed built against the rear of an old building. There appeared to be a solid wall of wood, but the masked man knew otherwise.
Hurry, Cranshaw. Where's that button that opens this thing?
But wait.
Make it fast if you value your life.
I'm opening it. Concealed button here.
The entire side of the wall swung up like a suspended garage door and revealed a passageway. Then a police spotlight pierced the alley and struck the Hornet and Cranshaw.
The police. They've seen this door.
Go on. Go ahead.
Shaken by fear and confused by the Hornet's plotting demands for fast action, Cranshaw ran through the long corridor with the masked man at his heels. He was only vaguely aware of the other shouts from far behind.
Keep going, Cranshaw. Right through the door into the gambling room.
What is he?
The room was filled with well-dressed people who were gathered around roulette tables.
Cranshaw, what's this mean?
Trig, the Hornet.
You open the door, the cops are coming.
But the Hornet, where did he go?
But Green Hornet had gone on through the room without pausing and into the empty corridor between the gambling room and the restaurant. He paused just long enough to snatch off his mask and remove his coat. The coat was reversible. He put it on inside out, then entered the restaurant and sauntered through to the other door. The diners had no knowledge of the confusion in the gambling room.
Get him up, all of you. It's the law speaking.
Burke, this is the evidence you wanted.
Quiet down, all of you. Take it easy. We just want the guys who run this place. Line up at that wall.
Yeah, make it snappy now.
Officer, the Green Hornet. Get the Green Hornet.
Save it, Cranshaw. We got you and Trig Burley and a fine lot of evidence against you.
But I...
Why, you mealy-mouthed fathead. Why'd you lead the cops here? Why'd you do it, Cranshaw?
Well, I...
Is this your gambling place, Cranshaw?
No, I...
Oh, yes, it is. You needn't think you can throw me and the boys to the wolves and become a white knight by leading a raid on a garden. Listen, copper, he's the owner of this joint, and I can prove it.
It was easier than I'd hoped, Cato. Cranshaw led the police right into the garden.
Will you have trouble getting away, Mr. Briggs?
Not a bit. I went through the gambling room to a corridor and took off my disguise. I was able to go through the restaurant without being noticed.
And Cranshaw led police in raid on own place. Was that very good?
Yeah, well, I'm going to make 2 phone calls and then to bed.
Will you dial private number of police commissioner?
Yes. Then I'm going to call Jim Donald and tell him to watch for the next edition of the Daily Sentinel.
You think he'll go to prison?
Perhaps for a short time, but we'll hold his job for him and we'll see that his wife gets medical care. After all, Cato, it was a public service to put Boss Cranshaw out of business, and Jim Donald is the one who started it. Hello, Commissioner. Britt Reed calling. You've heard about it, eh? Then you won't need to wait for the headlines. Yes, I suppose I have gotten several policemen somewhat steamed up, but I'm interested mainly in what the police commissioner thinks of the Green Hornet. How you doing, huh? Well, that's all that's necessary. If everything is okay with you, I'm satisfied.
This copyrighted feature originates in Detroit, and all characters, places, and incidents used are fictitious.
Oh, I guess I had some time. Yeah, that wasn't a very long episode, actually. I think it clocked in at 23 minutes. A Matter of Evidence, The Green Hornet. The original air date on that was this 20th of January, 1948. And again, it was created by George Trendle and Franz Stryker. The Lone Ranger began in 1933. The Hornet came about in 1936. And in some of my research, I've found that the Lone Ranger is a great granduncle to Britt Reed, publisher of the Daily Sentinel. I'm going to play a couple of songs out. This one's going to be Lonzo and Oscar. I'm My Own Grandpa, and if I have time, I'm going to do a Barney Rubble and Fred Flintstone duet in honor of the hero tandems, the Lone Ranger and Tonto, the Green Hornet and Kato. Hope you enjoy. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week.
It sounds funny, I know, but it really is so. Oh, I'm my own grandpa. I'm my own grandpa. It sounds funny, I know, but it really is so. Oh, I'm my own grandpa. Now many, many years ago, when I was 23, I was married to a widder who was pretty as could be. This widder had a grown-up daughter who had hair of red. My father fell in love with her, and soon they two were wed. This made my dad my son-in-law and changed my very life. My daughter was my mother, 'cause she was my father's wife. To complicate the matter, even though it brought me joy, I soon became the father of a bouncing baby boy. My little baby then became a brother-in-law to Dad, and so became my uncle, though it made me very sad. For if he was my uncle, then that also made him brother of the widder's grown-up daughter, who of course was my stepmother. I'm my own grandpa. I'm my own grandpa. It sounds funny, I know, but it really is so. Oh, I'm my own grandpa. Father's wife then had a son who kept them on the run, and he became my grandchild, for he was my daughter's son. My wife is now my mother's mother, and it makes me blue, because although she is my wife, she's my grandmother too. I'm my own grandpa. I'm my own grandpa. It sounds funny, I know, but it really is so. Oh, I'm my own grandpa. Is my grandmother, then I'm her grandchild. And every time I think of it, it nearly drives me wild. For now I have become the strangest case you ever saw. As husband of my grandmother, I am my own grandpa. I'm my own grandpa. I'm my own grandpa. It sounds funny, I know, but it really is so. Oh, I'm my own grandpa.
Here we are like we always are. When you're near, I'm never far. We're a matched and perfect set, never separated yet. In fact, we are the indisputable, it's positively irrefutable. You might say we're me and mutable teammates, teammates. We may stay scene. Nothing ever comes between us, 'cause we are the most reliable, definitely undeniable. It's like we're you and I above teammates, teammates. We when I broke my arm
last summer, you were the captain.
What else could I do? We're teammates through and through, me and you.
Teammates,
teammates, teammates.
When I exercise, it's you who always starts breathing fast.
How else could it be? We're suited to a T, you and me.
Teammates, teammates, teammates. Now that's the long and short of it.